They account for just 3% of India's 1.1 billion strong population, and about 2% of them are Catholic. Christians have been practicing their faith in the mostly Hindu nation for almost 2,000 years. But how did they first get there? It was St. Thomas, of Doubting Thomas fame, who first brought the good news to the huge East Asian nation. Centuries of oral traditions say Christ's apostle traveled there about the year 52 AD, when it's said he landed on India's southwestern shore of Malabar. Well, Father Bernie O'Connor of the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches told me more about St. Thomas's Christian legacy in India, and especially about how Christianity evolved there.
Here we are, we're going back to the first century AD. Thomas, Paul, Peter, all the apostles are traveling around. Thomas finds himself in India. There is a small Jewish community there, but there must be a lot of other cults, including Hinduism, which are being practiced at the time.
Most certainly. I think that that's certainly correct. When Thomas arrived in India, he certainly would have found the Jewish presence conspicuous, but it's not certain he was entirely welcomed. It probably became a sort of port of call, make the acquaintance and then feel a little bit uncomfortable and moving off in another direction. Hinduism would have been the dominant religion, no question about it. In the time that St. Thomas settled into his ministry, you would have had Hinduism as the majority. You would have had little movements within Hinduism, such as Jainism. And then you would have had a presence of Buddhism. So these three were actively associated with the areas in which he worked and ministered. Hinduism was well established in India, certainly by the time Thomas arrived. It's a 3,000-year-old religion before he ever stepped his toes on the Malabar coast. Among the views which it held, and this is significant, is what we know as the caste system, where people were defined according to their work. You had the very top-level class, known as the Brahmins, who we would associate with the intellectual elite. And it was to these that Thomas appears to have first addressed his message. And the result of that is that seven Christian communities arose from within the Brahmin caste, the highest level of caste. And the continuity of those, even today, we can find evidence of their having existed. But it's fascinating that he concentrated within that element. And the question arises, why? Well, perhaps it was because being intellectual, they were curious about matters of belief and understanding of the nature of philosophical questions and religious questions. They were open to listen, and they did listen, and they did respond. So Thomas focused his energy within those communities, and the results, of course, became known to us today, particularly in Kerala.
Well, of course, they would have also been able to read and write at that time.
Yes, but again, we're working with a predominantly oral tradition, mm-hmm. both within the culture and surrounding the culture. So Thomas preached. He addressed his message orally, as would have been the case within his homeland. It would have been the same. Definitely, Thomas certainly would have been able to read and write. He would have understood various languages.
Because the apostles were given the gift of tongues.
They were given the gift of tongues, but I wouldn't want that to be taken too literally. Because the miracle at Pentecost wasn't so much a miracle of speaking, it was a miracle of understanding. People understood them in their own languages. It's not that the apostles necessarily spoke those other languages.
We touched on it just briefly about how Christianity evolved in India, but give me a little bit more information about that. Over the centuries, how did Christianity and even the Catholic Church evolve?
Well, evolve is the word I think you very wisely chosen. Okay, let's start with St. Thomas's ministry. He's dying probably in Mylapore about the year 72. From the 4th century on, you find a change. The local communities, which have maintained Thomas's legacy, maintained the basic understanding of doctrine we even have today, there becomes an influence of what is called East Syrian tradition. Bear in mind, the life in the Western part of the world, including Rome, was in chaos. It was disintegrating. Communications became very, very poor. Contact association became difficult to maintain. So from the roughly the 4th until the 11th centuries, what happens is that those who became known as the St. Thomas Christians relied upon the influence of East Syria. Today it's present-day Iraq and Iran. And the Catholicos of an area known as Seleucia Ctesiphon, the head of the Iran-Iraq area, as we know it for the church, actually was requested to appoint bishops. There was a problem. If we can't get bishops through the intervention of Rome or somewhere else, where are we going to get them? So they turned to East Syria. The presence of East Syria in India was well known at that point. And for all those centuries, the East Syrians appointed bishops for India. Now, the interesting thing is that they tended to appoint not Indians, but their own Persians who went to India as Bishop of the St. Thomas Christians. And it wasn't until 1597, in fact, that we have the last East Syrian appointed bishop who dies at what is known as Angamali, a major Christian site, Mar Abraham. And then we have a drastic change. Going back just a little earlier, 100 years, 1498, you have the arrival of Portuguese explorers and adventurers. Vasco da Gama comes to mind. And he arrives at Kochi, and he goes to Costa Cade and various places. And what he does is began to examine with the missionaries who were with him the state of Christianity as they understood it among the Indian people. They were surprised to find a Christian presence. But what they thought is that it was a heretical Christian presence. Mm. Now, typical of a Western outlook, they don't have the same vestments. They don't have the same liturgical books. They don't have the same emphasis in their liturgy. They must be heretical. And they found occasional references to an individual known as Nestorius, what they thought were references to this well-known heretical teacher. And they concluded, therefore, the Thomas Christians were heretical, and that the best thing could be done was obliterate their tradition and history, annihilate it, and Latinize the whole batch, so we'll all look and act alike. Very Western in outlook. Now, the tragedy of that is that the Portuguese influence then took over, becomes known as Padroado, and the Portuguese acquired and maintained the right to appoint bishops. So the East Syrians disappear from the picture, the Portuguese enter the picture, and the Portuguese want total Latin church. Now, the result of this, there was a famous synod in 1599, known as De Emper, in which there were concrete efforts made to Latinize the Thomas Christians. Over the years, there was a great resentment, and appropriately so, to this Latinization process. And with the result, in 1653, there was an oath called the Kunin Cross Oath, whereby the Thomas Christians said, basically, we've had quite enough of this. So there was a period of separation. Others lived quietly under Latin domination. And it caused a great deal of division, of discord, of strife. And a number of the St. Thomas Christians to this day have not returned to communion with Rome as a result of the Latinization policies of the of that era. Interestingly enough, one of the groups with whom I work, known as the Siramalankara Church, re-entered communion with the Holy See only in 1930. And today number about 500,000. Absolutely remarkable and exemplary church. So fundamentally, you can see the movement. St. Thomas, then East Syrian influence, then Padroado Latinization influence. You see, as early as 1700, attempts by the Holy See to try to enter into the picture in some way to bring a little more accord. Propaganda, evangelization of peoples, we call it, begins to seek to have representation and to have a voice. Delegations are sent to Rome as early as 1778 to try to work out some kind of method in which this kind of division can cease. What eventually happens, 1887, Pope Leo XIII decides on the separation of Latin Catholics in India and Malabar or Thomas Christians. So now we're going to see two different aspects of the church active within the Indian situation. And by 1896, we're seeing dioceses called vicariates set up in Trishur Ernakulam, Shenganisherry. And this continues on to the point that in 1992, eventually, you have the Syro-Malabar Christians being designated as a sui juris, or autonomous church communion within the Catholic family. And that basically is the situation we have today. In India, we have the Latin Christians. Think back to Vasco da Gama and the missionaries and adventurers. We have the Malabar Christians. Think back to St. Thomas himself. You have the Malankara Church. Again, think in terms of the division that unfortunately came about in the 17th century and its eventual restoration in 1930. So there we are today.
Now, what about the dialogue between these different communities?
There are segments of the St. Thomas Christian, for example, Jacobites, which are not in communion with the Holy See. But the Malabar have never broken association with the Holy See or fidelity. In fact, this becomes a point of remarkable pride, and the Malabar tradition absolutely rejoices in the fact that their communion has been an unbroken one from St. Thomas himself.
So and
it's a wonderful, absolutely.
But it's the St. Thomas Church, then, that is not in full communion with...
Well, the St. Thomas Christians are not monolithic. You have the Malankara are a part of the St. Thomas Christians. Mm-hmm. You have the Syro-Malabar are St. Thomas Christians. And you also have various Orthodox churches in India that are recognized as having had descendancy lineage, if you will, from St. Thomas. And some of those are not part of the Catholic communion. Some are, some aren't, within the whole St. Thomas family. So the term St. Thomas Christians is an umbrella one, and it covers the whole scope of those both in communion and not.
Okay. Now, how is the dialogue going between those who are in communion and those who are not?
I think this is a very important question. But let's take it back a little further. What about dialogue among those in communion? In the Catholic Bishops' Conference of India, the current president and the current vice president are Eastern Christians. They're St. Thomas Christians. The majority of the members of the conference are, however, Latin. So we already have a wonderful symbol of the fact that the three rites not only coexist, the three rites cooperate, and they seek ways to develop mutual understanding and exchange and reciprocity. I would like to see that furthered still, but I'm very encouraged by the many signs of hope for an exemplary expression of dialogue within the three churches in communion in India. Now, for those outside communion, I notice at the house where I live, the Domus Romana here in Rome, that periodically there will be delegates from various Orthodox churches who will come to Rome for consultations with the Council of Christian Unity. And among them are various Orthodox traditions of India who are not in communion. Jacobite is one I've mentioned. And they will tell me increasingly of the respect that they have for one another, of using research resources together, of sometimes setting up social services and charitable institutions and assisting each other in that process. They'll talk about their love and commitment to the example given by the major archbishops, Fathia Thill and Mark Clemens. And it's a wonderful, wholesome spirit that they tell me has not been consistent in modern history, but certainly is evident today. So dialogue continues, and I'm very optimistic, and I've heard from some bishops the expectation it may result in full communion within our lifetime.
Oh, wouldn't that
for
be
many,
wonderful.
Many of these Eastern non-communion churches.
Well,
we can hope. We can pray.
Let's hope and pray that that does one day happen. How many Christians live in India today, and how many of those are Catholic?
There are approximately 3% of the population of India who are Christian. Now, we also have to remember that for much of India's history, from the 19th century on at least, we have the presence of the British and the efforts of the established church in England, namely the Church of England, to dominate India while she was there. So there's certainly an influence for conversion activities. Approximately 3%. How many are Catholic in communion? About 2%. And people say, well, Father Bernie, that isn't very many. Excuse me, it's more than the whole population of Canada.
You're kidding. How many people are we talking about?
Well, there's 35 million people in Canada, and 2% of 1.2 billion, one would have to do the math, but it's greater than the population of Canada.
Father Bernard O'Connor there, from the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches. A very warm thanks to him.